So my name is Estelle Pearson. For those of you who don't know me, I am the current president of the Actuaries Institute, and I'm going to be your facilitator today. Now, this is our inaugural half-day general insurance GI glimpse, and the aim of the seminar is really to allow you as young or younger actuaries to have a glimpse into the opportunities and challenges of the general insurance industry today and into the future. Now, I have to say, as an old GI actuary, I'm also looking forward to this afternoon's programme because it looks really interesting to everybody. I have to say, from the moment that I moved into general insurance from superannuation about 25 plus years ago, I really fell in love with general insurance, and what I really enjoyed about the industry was it was so varied and dynamic, and there were always new problems and issues to think about. And I guess in that way things haven't changed, but what has changed, I think, is the speed of change. And so that makes it difficult to keep abreast of everything that's going on, and I think that's why events such as today are so valuable. Now, on behalf of the Institute, I'd like to acknowledge and thank our sponsor, PwC, who are sponsoring Plenary Session 2 today. Now, if you are a social media user, Sharanjit in particular, we invite you to follow the summit on Twitter and to do your own tweets. Be good if you've got quite a few tweets from today, and to keep up to date with what's happening by using, have we got it?
It's just
@ Actuaries. Okay, @ Actuaries Inst on Twitter. And also, can you just check that your mobile phones are turned on to silent? All right, so we move to our keynote address, and the topic is cars of the future. And Sue Cratchley is going to give this address. Now, cars are immensely important to the insurance industry because premiums from motor vehicle risk make up almost 40% of the total industry premiums. So the way that cars are changing and what that means for insurance risk and insurers is obviously really important to understand. I think, Steve, you're going to talk for about 35 minutes, and then there'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions. There will be a roving mic for the questions because the session's being recorded. So when you have a question in the question and answer time at the end of the session, just put your hand up and wait for the mic, and then identify yourself before you ask your question. So I'll introduce Steve now. Steve is an advanced technology pricing manager with the customer and business pricing at Suncor. He's a specialist on advanced automated technologies and has been investigating these for many years. He's particularly well connected worldwide in this space with those working with these technologies. His role at Suncor has been to identify strategic risks in the business and develop and manage options to mitigate those risks. So if you'd all please introduce Steve. Introduce Steve to the set.
Thank you. I'll give you a little bit of my background as well, a bit beyond just recently. So I've been working at Suncorp for about 11 years now. Started actually in the call centre. I wanted a job a couple of days a week. I was a keen photographer, looking for a bit of extra money for lenses and things. Did not expect I'd have a career in insurance. Definitely didn't think I'd have a career in pricing. I've been in pricing now for about 8 years. So I still can't count 20. I'm not an actuary type person. There's a lot of more interesting people than me here today. But what I have done is I've managed to carve out a role where I actually focus and advise the business on future technology and how that's going to impact our business going forward. So in 2010, 2011, I was the crazy guy at meetings talking about collision mitigation, about cars not crashing, and eventually about cars driving themselves, and literally was the crazy guy in the room. Now I've kind of become a bit of the guru, the oracle, what do you want to call me? So somehow I feel lucky with that. Glad it went in the direction it did, otherwise I think I'd have a shorter career than what I've had. So what I'm talking today is about how this technology has emerged, where it's come from, where it's going to, and potentially how it's going to impact our business. And I don't think there'd be anyone today that would doubt it's going to impact our business. It really will. Okay. Hope I get this to work. So, okay. So I want to give a little bit of history first of all. One of the things that I want to call out is that this isn't new technology. It's one of the big myths that a lot of people don't seem to understand. people have been working on autonomous vehicles, cars driving themselves, since the 40s and 50s. And there's a video, I know Nick's seen it, a few other people have seen it, where cars and basically research institutes across the US had wires embedded in roads and all sorts of, you know, sort of old world computers, cars full of transistors, actually driving themselves around tracks and being demonstrated at world fairs and science fairs in the 60s, 70s and 80s. So it's not new technology. But what has happened is, since the sort of late 90s and early noughties, that's where acceleration really started to happen in this field. And the main accelerator was the DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the military in the US. And they had a vision that in 2015, so this year, half of all trucks in war zones would be autonomous. The reason for that is body bags coming home doesn't represent well to the public. They wanted the trucks to be driving themselves between point A and point B, delivering munitions, delivering supplies, whatever the case may be. They've actually hit that goal. All trucks now in war zones can be driven autonomously, about 50%, 60%. But to do that, they knew they had to actually engage industry, engage academia. It wasn't something they could develop in-house. So they created a series of challenges with cash prizes to find the best and brightest from around the world to actually work on the problem. So the first challenge, you can sort of see that Caterpillar-type vehicle there. You know, 1,001 sensors on it, probably about, about a $2 million vehicle once it had all the kit and caboodle on it. So just ridiculously priced, running very slow. The first challenge, I think two vehicles actually completed the challenge through the desert, the rest failed. And they were just crawling along, going all over the place. It looked like wacky races or something like that. It was pretty insane. Then they moved into a urban challenge, and this is where things got interesting. And this is the third one, it was a bit of the second one, but I'll skip that. But the third one is where it got interesting, because that's where vehicles were operating in an urban environment with streets, stop signs, traffic lights, and other vehicles, other test-type vehicles. And they were doing it at speed. Not 60Ks, not 80Ks, but 20, 30 kilometres an hour. And it really showed, in about 2 or 3 years, how fast the technology was improving. And it demonstrated DARPA that they were actually on the right path. They actually could get this technology on military trucks and actually in war zones. But of course, that then spawned an entire new industry around civilian use. And that's what we're seeing today. So a couple of vehicles you can see on the screen there. You've got, get this laser working, the current, the old Google vehicle with the big LiDAR unit on the top there. When that came out, that little piece of equipment was worth about $270,000 each for each one of those units. So you couldn't have one of those in every passenger car running around, just you couldn't afford the vehicle. The new Koala car, which is what it's being called affectionately, that's the dome up there. It's now down to $40,000 per unit. There's a company in San Francisco that's releasing that, that basically technology, that unit there. It's going to be on each four corners of the vehicle. So about the size next year of a cigarette packet, the year after the size of a postage stamp. In 2 years' time, each one of those postage stamps will be worth $250. So that gives an indication of how rapidly the technology is being developed and the costs are coming down. And it was interesting because I went to a conference a couple of years ago, and the guy that makes this one, Velodrome, used to actually make high-end stereo gear. He was saying, he was asked by one of the universities, why does that unit cost $270,000, $240,000 per unit? His response was, no one else makes them and I can charge what I want. So you can imagine the other players in the room that are working in robotics and sciences thinking, well, there's someone waiting to be disrupted, and he's been voluntarily disrupted. So he's dropped his price down to $40,000 with the new ones. There's a Ford Focus that runs around the US with a couple of hairspray-type ones that are $10,000 a pop, but you need four of those, so it's still around that $40,000 mark to cover the same sort of images. But the new one that's coming out is a solid state. There's no spinning parts in it, and basically, yeah, $250 a pop. So it's just going ahead in leaps and bounds. Okay. One of the things that we're focusing on at the moment is that, and most people don't understand this, is that we're not going to jump from what we have today to a self-driving car. All the manufacturers, all the OEMs, are working towards a stepping stone approach, a pathway towards automation. Everyone in this room would have currently a semi-autonomous car. Now that means, does it have ABS? Does it have traction control? Is the car making decisions for you already? Most of us, they are. Unless you've got an old classic from the 80s or 70s, something like that perhaps, but anything from probably the mid-90s, the cars are making decisions for you and you just don't realise it. But what we're going to see is moving from a completely different cars making a few little decisions to help you maybe stay on the road or something like that to making lots of decisions for you and actually correcting your errors. So some of the stepping stones we're going to see, full self-parking. So at the moment, you see some of the self-parking. Some people have probably got it in their new vehicles at the moment. But you may have to do the throttle and the brake yourself, and the steering wheel, the wheel turns itself. So that will go and just be the car parks itself. BMW actually released what they call in their valet parking, and a few others are talking about valet parking, where you actually jump out of the car and you park the car with your remote. So there's no more doors opening, there's no more trying to get in that tight space. You actually stop, jump out, zip, zip, park. Now, I don't know if anyone's played with radio-controlled cars, but it's going to be a bit of fun to watch how that goes at first. But the car will have sensors that will actually avoid, you know, collisions itself. So if you try and put it sideways into a spot that it won't fit, it will actually stop you doing that. So, and it's interesting because that was shown at CES this year. The 7 Series BMW that's going to be announced in about 3 days' time, I didn't say this year, is actually going to have that technology on it in Australia. And that'll be on the roads next year here. So it's not 20 years, 5 years, 3 years away, it's next year. We're going to see city speed self-driving, so self-driving at low speeds. We're seeing that on vehicles already on roads in Australia today. We're also seeing highway speed, the Volvo XC90 that's coming out. It's on the roads at the moment. There's a 2016 model coming out later on this year. Basically, I'll be able to drive from Brisbane to Noosa. I'll have to touch the wheel by law, or as someone did in early autobahns, got a Coke can and used gaffer tape to actually put it to the wheel and then climb to the back seat and watch the car drive itself. Abby didn't like that. So you'll be able to sit there and just relax, you know, play with your phone, maybe, talk to the kids, whatever the case may be. But the car will drive itself. The Volvos will stay in the lane. They'll accelerate, they'll brake. If the car in front, you know, suddenly brakes, it'll slow down, match their speed. Once they accelerate, it'll accelerate again. You won't be touching the throttle, you won't be touching the brake. It'll turn the corners, everything else. Another feature will be you can lock onto a car in front in cities and things. So as the car goes through a roundabout, it will go through the roundabout and just follow it through. So the car will just become an extension of, you know, your thoughts about driving. It will just do it. And you'll, in theory, at the moment, have to be the observer and watch what it's doing, but then down the track you won't do that. We'll then get to V2X systems. So does anyone know what V2X means? Have you heard that term before? So V to V, vehicle to vehicle, and V2X is vehicle to other, vehicle to anything else, pedestrians, cyclists, infrastructure, whole range of technology. And this is where we really start getting into big data and that sort of thing that will be in your world, especially in years to come. So the vehicles of the future, every vehicle will be another node on the Internet of Things, collecting data, gathering data, sending data back to manufacturers, insurers, repairers, a whole range of companies, road manufacturers, road management systems. And it's interesting because that V2V, there's a lot of debate about spectrum, about, you know, conflicts between that and other systems. But where it is interesting is the V2V technology, by 2020, they're estimating 60% of all vehicles sold in Australia will be connected to the internet. And we'll have the top technology on board. There's vehicles that will be sold from 2016 that will have V2V capabilities. And V2V, why it's so interesting from an insurance point of view, what it means is if you come to, say, a blind intersection, so two intersections, two cars coming like this, each car tells the other car where it's doing, what speed it's going, the velocity, and can actually warn the driver at this point, no, you're going to have a collision if you keep accelerating that way until this driver stops and this one will go through. In the future, it'll actually do that warning, but then tell the vehicle to slow and stop itself. So at the moment, we'll get those, basically, signals to the driver. There's a company, and you sort of think, well, this is overseas, this is foreign, it's not Australia. The world leader in that technology is a company called Coda Wireless, and they're based in Adelaide, with offices in Germany and offices in Detroit. So this stuff is actually being developed here and shipped all over the world. So we're not getting foreign stuff here, we're actually exporting this technology to the globe. So pretty interesting stuff. In-vehicle apps. Bit of a hot one, maybe, because there's been a little bit of hacking as a result of this. So this is where infotainment systems, with your vehicle being constantly connected, you'll be downloading apps, those apps will be gathering data, sending data to all sorts of people. And if you think of a world of insurance, telematics apps, pay-as-you-drive insurance apps, basically getting risk profiles on individual drivers and individual vehicles. It really changes that, you know, complete shift in how you actually look at risk and how you potentially price risk. If you're not talking about a car and an age of a driver and where they live, perhaps where they go, you know exactly how they drive, where they go, times of day, how far they go, that sort of thing. So it really changes how we actually view risk. Highway speed, self-driving, platooning. Anyone heard of that one before? No, this is scary as hell. Basically, platooning is where you have a series of cars or a series of trucks, is what they're working on at the moment, basically doing 100-120 k's about 5 centimetres apart. So each vehicle is locked onto the vehicle in front, which is locked onto the vehicle in front, which is locked onto the lead vehicle. They're developing a business model in Europe at the moment where, for heavy haulage, a trucking company will actually offer a platoon to other truckers, and basically, if you're the lead truck, your company gets paid to be the lead driver. And you'll be observing your truck, you'll be maybe controlling, but there's already self-driving trucks being tested in Nevada at the moment. But you'll be the controller of that platoon. You'll then book your spot on that platoon and pay for that privilege of going in that platoon. You might join it at COFS, or you might join it at Port Macquarie, and you pay for that distance from here to, say, Brisbane. And where it's interesting is that the drivers of those trucks, if you can only drive, say, 8 hours, I think the legal limits in Australia for heavy haulage, are you driving if you're actually part of the platoon? Does that mean you'd actually start the platoon out, heading up the F3, sit back, relax, watch TV, have a snooze while the actual platoon's going along, then you're going to pull off or maybe go a bit further beyond Brisbane, you actually take control just before Brisbane, and you're in theory for another 8 hours driving ahead of you as part of your logbook. So it may extend the distance you can drive without a driver change, but also you get fuel efficiency, you get less wear and tear on the truck, and it basically really reduces the trucking costs if it works. The same thing being developed for passenger cars. With passenger cars, they had a problem where radiators were getting smashed by rocks getting flipped up, so they're still working through that slight issue, but they'll get there with it. We then see second collision avoidance, and this is really exciting technology. It's crazy technology. So this is where you have a crash. Crashes will happen, much less, but they will still happen. This technology is designed to actually get you out of that second crash. So if you get someone hit you up the rear and push you into oncoming traffic, the car will sense that and work out, where do I place this vehicle so I do not have a second crash? And it could be using ABS, traction, steering. You could be unconscious. The vehicle will just do this for you and get you to the side of the road. And it could be a wreck on three wheels, but it'll still try and get you there. And that technology is being developed. So it'll survive the first incident and then try and avoid the second one. We'll then get point-to-point self-drive with some driver interaction, and probably a good description of that is level 3 tech, which we'll talk about in a moment. Then we'll get the fully autonomous point-to-point. And I've sort of got that graphic there that I drive at the moment. We're really moving into a space where we gain to drive, the car and the driver will work together, and then we'll get to the point where the car just drives you. You're a passenger in the vehicle no matter which seat you're sitting in. And that's the future we're heading towards. But it is a stepping stone, a pathway we're heading. I put this one in just recently. This was released in the last couple of weeks. And why it's interesting is it's the hypercurve of all the technology coming through at the moment. Everything from IoT platforms, biochips, which freaky come on. These are all sorts of stuff I've been working on at Suncorp. But autonomous vehicles is actually right at the top of that hypercurve. Everyone's starting to hear about it. Everyone's starting to see it. Everyone's starting to see news reports. And it's starting to get in the front of people's minds. Now, in Australia, a lot of people think this is just happening overseas. You see stuff from the US and EU and other places like that. The first Australian autonomous vehicle conference will be held in November in Adelaide this year. There will be on-road demonstrations where they're shutting down the freeways for 6 hours to do on-road demos. I encourage everyone to be there. So if you just do a search, you'll actually find details for it on some different websites. But their registration will open in about 2 weeks' time. So this isn't just happening overseas anymore. It is happening here. And you'll see more and more media reports and more stories about it in local reports. And if you look at the time frame down the bottom there, 5 to 10 years. And that's for autonomous vehicles. Okay. So automation levels. This is where we start getting into lots of debate in the industry. So like every new piece of technology, no one can agree on standards. You've got all these different groups that think their standard's perfect, and then you get someone else to think their standard's perfect, and the manufacturers, they want their standards. There's a few groups that are sort of coming out and trying to sort of realign the standards together or trying to get the right standards. So the SAEA, which is basically the repair industry, the servicing industry, the mechanical industry, they've got one set which goes to 0 to 5, which is this one on this side. And then you've got the other one over the other side there, which is really what the DMV in America is sort of using. And that seems to be the more widely adopted one. So when you talk about it, you'll hear people talk about level 3 automation or level 4. Most people are talking about this, but you may see stories in the media from either. So it depends on who's reporting it as to which one they use. So we're not getting any common terminology at the moment. But it's interesting because most vehicles are starting to get in this, and we're moving into this, and we're already seeing some moving into that already. So 5 years ago, that was 2030. Now, I'd say by 2020, we're going to have absolutely that available in showrooms, without a doubt, and then that, potentially. I'll talk about timeframes in a moment. If, to give you an example of some level 4 cars that we're seeing today, those Google Koala cars, they're level 4. The ones in Milton Keynes, have you seen those? The pods in Milton Keynes? So these guys have actually beat Google to the punch. They're building 40 pods that will interact with pedestrians, cyclists, other vehicles on the roads, running between the city centre and sort of outlying the railway centre, something like that. And it's basically a little two-seater pod. Runs fully autonomously. It's not running on a track like you see at the Heathrow Airport with the little pods they've got. This is actually operating in amongst people. They're building 40 of them at the moment. They were supposed to launch in July. That's been pushed back to September. So we'll see it late this month. We've met the guys, we've sat in the pods and played with them. It's pretty impressive technology. So they're actually beating Google, because Google have got their vehicles on roads, but the public aren't in them yet. The public will be in these late this year. So it's not 2020, 2025, it's happening now. So I'm lucky enough to have great relationships with some of the tier one suppliers. So people like Bosch, Continental, Delphi, Denso, a few others like that. And I do get to play in some of their advanced vehicles from time to time. Sometimes I can talk about it, sometimes I can't. Bosch are fantastic in that I'm allowed to give you a bit of information about what they're doing, give you a view of a video that they've just released in the last sort of couple of weeks. So I actually like to spruik Bosch because they are a great company. So Bosch at the moment, they're looking at, in level 3 type vehicles, how do we actually ensure that people, they want to drive at times, but then there's other times they don't want to drive. So they're looking at that sort of level 3 type scenario at this point in time. So what they're doing is, there's times where you're overwhelmed. You're in a city environment, pedestrians, cyclists, crazy bus drivers, crazy drivers, all happening around you. Or you get this other period here where you're understimulated. You're on a long, straight country road, which in Australia has actually one of the highest fatality rates. People fall asleep at the wheels. So in those modes, they want you to be able to hit the button and actually just sit back and relax. Let the car do the work. You don't need to be driving, the car's doing the driving for you. And the technology does that now, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But if you're on a Saturday night, you're in a convertible, the top's down, the stars are out, why not drive yourself? You know, nice windy road. We enjoy driving. At some point we won't be able to, but at this stage you still can. So that's where they see this sort of driving pleasure. Where people enjoy driving at this point, you should still be able to. At this point. Okay. So, who's working on this technology? This is where it gets crazy. So, I would not know a manufacturer in the world not having an autonomous vehicle program. Chinese manufacturers. Chinese have actually instructed their vehicle manufacturers to do partnerships with their tech companies to develop this tech and put this tech in vehicles. China's announced they're going to have a level 4 autonomous vehicle on road in 2016. To me, that's pretty scary. They actually tested an autonomous truck, an army truck, running up and down the public freeway about 2 years ago. There are lots of reports about the start of the trip. There were no reports at the end of the trip, so I'm not sure what happened. Not sure what happened between. It may not be a good news story, but anyway. But you also see all the tier 1 part suppliers. And the tier 1 suppliers are the guys that are actually developing this technology, and this is where it's quite unusual. In the 1980s, most vehicle manufacturers outsourced their R&D. They felt they were putting too much money in R&D, it was costing them too much money. You know, some of the stuff was getting to market, some wasn't. So rather than them doing it themselves, they'll actually outsource it. So they outsourced to Bosch, to Continental, to Denso, to Delphi. They are now, basically, they're locked to those suppliers. So a Bosch ABS unit will be in about 20 different brands that you drive today. You wouldn't know because the part will have Mercedes or BMW or whatever on the sticker, but it's the same part that's in half the car park around you. So the tier one suppliers are actually really controlling this technology. So when you go and talk to people about the tech, you get much more information about from the tier ones than from the vehicle manufacturers themselves, because they're the ones that know it, the tier ones know what's happening. So if you look at Bosch, Delphi, Denso, so Delphi and Denso, I think it was Delphi, drove across the US in a vehicle, broke the laws all the way in full autonomous mode from one side to the other. Companies like Zoox, this is this one just here. I know the CEO of Zoox, a couple of crazy Aussies that were working in advertising. They wanted to build autonomous limousines. Couldn't get any VC funding in Australia, tried pretty hard for a couple of years, went to the US, had a demo, had it all stand at the back of the LA Motor Show, had two VC meetings. Their companies were now valued at $250 million. They've got IP license from Stanford, and they've got some of the best minds in the world working with them to take on Google. Their plans are to launch that, a variation of that, in Vegas as an autonomous limousine running between the resorts in 2020. There is no driver, there are no steering wheel, there's no pedals. They're thinking about putting card tables and crap tables inside them, so maybe a bit extra income stream for them. But what's interesting is that these guys, because they come from creatives, they're actually coming out with novel ways to solve problems that the Googles of the world then come up with 18 months later, because they're going down that engineer sort of mindset of this, then that, then that. So, I can't think of a lot of vehicles, which I could, but I'll give you an example. That vehicle, one of the main reasons they're waiting, is for 5G. So if the vehicle has some sort of system failure, a control room will actually take control of the vehicle, drive the occupant to the destination, then bring the vehicle into a service centre, fix the problem. The passengers will have no idea there was even an issue with the vehicle. So it's basically they're going to hire air traffic controllers to actually sit in the control room. I've seen the control room they've built, and they'll take control as needed. Won't be often, but it's the backup plan. That the question always is, what happens if the system fails? Well, their answer is, you take over control. They came up with that about 18 months, 2 years ago. Google announced that about 3 months ago. Gives you the different mindset and approach to problems that these guys have got. Then you get people like NASA teaming up with Nissan. And you think, well, why would NASA team up with Nissan? I mean, that's a strange sort of concept. All the exploration they're doing in space now is autonomous vehicles. All the Mars rovers, all those sort of things are basically technology being developed that then assists or co-developed with companies like Nissan and Bosch and Denso and Delphi and others. So it's an actually logical partnership that at first doesn't make sense. Toyota recently announced that their collision mitigation technology, the one that stops you crashing the car in front, used to be $3,000, $3,500. This year, across the US, it ranged between $300 and $600 for every car in their fleet, and they're rolling that out across the world. So the technology is just coming out in leaps and bounds. Every university in America has autonomous vehicle programs. Some are much better than others. Carnegie Mellon, I can never say that, is probably one of the world leaders, but they're much quieter about their work. The Apple autonomous car that no one supposedly knows about, that we all know about, that's actually a partnership between Apple and Carnegie Mellon. And we'll see that vehicle. They're doing some testing on a military base at the moment in the US, and then we'll see that probably. There's rumours it might get announced tomorrow or the day after when they do their big Apple conference, but it'll be more likely next year before it gets announced. So I put up this slide because I wanted to give you guys an indication of the disruption that we're going to face. Does anyone in this room know any of those brands on screen? And not the Daniel, not the one at the top, but the one in the centre there. Put your hand up if you know any one of those. Oh. They were the world's largest coach builders before the horseless carriage came into production. So these were the Holdens, the GMs, the Toyotas, the Mazdas, the Mitsubishis, before Henry Ford developed the production line and the A Model Ford. Every one of those brands went broke in 10 years. If you think about our place in the auto sector, in that world, are we the boot maker, the saddle maker, the stirrup maker? How do we remain relevant when there's so much change coming our way? And there's a lot of change coming. So it's really interesting. And Daimler, the head of Daimler that ran through this, and he said that their view is only the paranoid survive, and Daimler are very paranoid about the future. They are actively working now to ensure they are relevant in the next 10, 15, 20 years. Otherwise, they're going to go the way of Kodak. And that's why people like me at Suncorp are doing much the same. Okay. The day Bosch tried to kill me. So, in late 2013, as I said, I've got a great relationship with Bosch. I've been to motor shows and stuff all over the world. I'm very lucky and privileged and about to head off to Tokyo in a couple of weeks for their motor show. But Bosch, the worldwide head of the program, invited me over after I went to the Frankfurt Motor Show and said, look, come out, we'll have a 4-hour chat about what our plans are. So I spent 4 hours with the head of their program, the global head of their program, and then they said at the end, why don't we jump in one of the vehicles and we'll go play on the auto bar. This was a public road, trucks, cars doing 240 kilometres an hour, pretty crowded day on the motorway. The vehicle wasn't that actual one, but very similar. It had a big LiDAR unit on the top, some sensors around here, some sensors sort of in here, which you can't really see that well, but a similar vehicle to that. production car retrofitted with the technology. And they basically take a donor car from then BMW, it's now Tesla they're using, but back then BMW, fit the tech to it, and then it was their experimental vehicle, which they didn't tell me until after the test ride, anyway. So we had a high-skilled driver in the driver's seat in case something goes wrong, which is always reassuring. I was sitting in the front passenger seat, and then in the back we had the worldwide head of the program, her PA, and a techie, just to basically monitor some stuff on a laptop that was happening with the vehicle, as they always needed to do. So they said, let's drive to the freeway, we'll show it's a normal car. So he thought it was Fangio, so he got from here to the freeway in about 30 seconds flat, and went through roundabout sideways, and yeah, I'm a driver, so I enjoyed that. We then got on the freeway, and they said, okay, we've programmed the vehicle to go for about 40, 50 kilometres up the freeway, doing about 120 k's, hit the red button in between you and the driver, and we'll just then take our hands and feet off. Okay, I hit the red button. My hands then gripped the steering, the seatbelt. To this day, I think my imprint is still on that seatbelt. But it was terrifying for the first 5 minutes. It really was. But then after that, you actually forget that no one's driving the car. We then had a meeting for 40 minutes up the freeway, another 40 minutes back down the freeway, when no one was looking at the front windscreen. We're talking about the car, talking about the technology, you forget we're doing 120 k's on a crowded motorway. And at one point, a truck, so we're in a three-lane road at one point, and there were trucks on the right of us, because they drive on the wrong side of the road, so the trucks on the right of us, and they were doing about 80 k's. And the vehicle detected, as we were starting to overtake it, the truck was drifting towards our lane. So they actually came up with this little iPad-type device in between the center, in the console, and he said, oh, quick, look at this, in the German accent, I'm, again. And then it just basically highlighted the truck had just drifted to the left a bit. The car slowed down, watched what the truck was doing. When the truck started drifting back away again, it then just accelerated past. Now, I can't think of any driver that a truck that you're about a third of the way past would even pick that up, but they've moved maybe that much in their lane towards you. You're doing 120 k's, they're doing 80 k's. So for collision mitigation, collision avoidance type technology, then find out this is still their experimental vehicle, and I wanted to buy it, and I'm a driver, but I wanted to buy this today for long commutes and things like that. They said, oh no, it's still being experimented, we're still working on it, it's not quite there yet. To me, I'd have that in my car tomorrow, without a shadow of a doubt. And that was now 2 years ago. So give you an idea of where it's gone now. So I'll show you this video, I'm hoping this will work. This is where Bosch see what's going to happen over the next year or so.
For a highly automated car and its unique driving experience. Although it looks like your common everyday car, a host of smart new features ensures that driving is no longer a chore. It helps to reduce the load on the driver by taking care of highway driving. Philip, a young professional, has been using his new car for a few weeks now. The car has been learning from his routines and can predict destinations. On selecting the destination, the car allows Philip to optimize his time by balancing the share between manual and automated driving. As Philip sets off, he looks at the upper left corner of the instrument cluster where the drive state indicator is located. It is a quick reference for the time left in the current driving mode. Apart from the regular navigation view, the split display provides Philip with an overview of his route. With this, Philip has a clear picture of where automation is available. He can access additional features with any of the menu on the left. As he approaches the ramp to the highway, one of the maps switches to the top view so that he has a better view of his surroundings. After entering the highway, the drive state indicator communicates to Philip that automation is available. Also, two special buttons on the steering wheel start glowing. As Philip presses them simultaneously for 3 seconds, the car switches to automated mode. Philip can now confidently take his hands off the wheel as he controls.
Yeah,
they just
love this at the moment.
With the free time in hand, Philip decides to get some work done and opens his office inbox via app. For a better view, he moves the inbox to the top panel and goes through his unread messages. Philip can perform common action by interacting with the on-screen buttons or with voice commands. He starts to dictate his reply to an email. It's not the same as working at his desk, but with the new car, Philip can be productive even while on the road. While on the highway, the car encounters a slower moving vehicle in front and sees an opportunity to change lanes. It communicates its intention by displaying a visual on the instrument cluster and a notification on the central display. If Philip wishes, he can select this notification to access the top view and monitor the maneuver. Once the car has completed the maneuver, Philip can rate it based on common driving parameters. This helps the car to learn his preferences and to improve its motion behavior for better comfort. Having taken care of all the important work, Philip still has some time left before taking back manual control. He decides to relax and watch a few online videos. When it is time for Philip to take back control, he is notified in steps. With a few minutes left, the drive state indicator switches to orange, and then red, depending on the urgency of the situation. If Philip still doesn't take back control at this point, the car would find the next safe spot on the shoulder and pull over. Switching to manual mode happens in the same way as activating automation. As Philip presses the buttons simultaneously for 3 seconds, the car switches back to manual mode. On reaching his destination, the car provides Philip with some smart statistics on his journey. At a glance, Philip can compare the efficiency of the car in manual and automated modes, and also his savings. From being a mere mode of transport, the car has evolved to become a part of Philip's digital lifestyle. It allows him to be productive when he is on the move and can be relied upon for needs far beyond mobility.
So, to give an idea, Bosch had those cars on the road in the US testing at the moment, and watch this space in Australia. That's all I can say. Okay. So my final slide. What can we expect? So what does the future hold? For us, this is probably the biggest concern we have. You know, for our business, it's a $2.5 billion book. It's fairly important to what we do. My boss keeps telling me. Collision avoidance will be the norm in most cars. Originally, I would have said in 10 years' time, the AMA came out in Australia and basically called for this to be standard on new vehicles sold today. I'd say in 2018, we're going to see that as standard on all new vehicles in Australia. There's calls for it in the US, there's calls for it in Europe at the moment. All heavy haulage trucks sold in the EU from 1st of November this year are required to have collision mitigation tech as standard. So the technology is production ready. So, connected vehicles, as I spoke before about, V2X or V2V, vehicles are going to be connected and talking to each other, and more importantly, talking to insurers. We're going to have completely different risk information and ways to price and select risk than ever before. Potentially OEMs will have that information, so it's going to be an interesting period. Digital licenses, pretty interesting one, this one. It's something that the Nevada DMV have been talking about for a number of years, and others are now starting to pick up on it. And it's where your smartphone will have your license in it. The car and the phone will talk when you get in and make sure that you're legally able to drive that vehicle or program that vehicle or ride in that vehicle. So car theft potentially could be eliminated. And the interesting thing that they're talking about is that even to the point where if I get in the car and my mate gets in the car and he's licensed to drive and I'm not, the phone will know when I say the command at the start where I'm sitting. If I'm sitting in the passenger seat and I'm licensed, it won't start the car. If I'm in the driver's seat, it will start the car. But then where it gets even more interesting is, if I'm driving in manual mode and I go through a speeding sign, it will ping my phone and my license straight away, charge me the fine straight away. If I don't have enough credit on my credit card, the car will pull to the side of the road. If I don't have enough points left, the car will pull to the side of the road. So unlicensed driving, drunk driving, things like that will almost be eliminated. And when you think about how many of those sorts of incidents, you know, impact us. Yeah. The other thing where it gets interesting is because autonomous vehicle technology can enable this disabled, the young, the people that can't drive at the moment. In the US, there's 20% of eligible people can't drive these days due to either war injuries or medical reasons. Those people will be enabled to be able to get into a car and program where to go, not take control. So you imagine, okay, my 14-year-old, I don't have kids, thank God, if my 14-year-old wants to go to soccer, I may be able to actually get them, allow them to get an autonomous car, program to go to soccer, and off they go. But I won't be able to put a child in a bassinet in the back seat and send it off by itself. So that's why they're talking about having a digital license to control who and who can't operate or use or ride in an autonomous vehicle. So it's interesting technology they're looking at. Level 4 pods. They're going to start off in CBD areas. They're going to be doing that last mile, first mile, pick you up at Central, drop you off at a meeting in, you know, Jackson Street, wherever the case may be. That's where we'll start seeing them. And the reason why is it allows you to get used to the technology, get comfortable with it. It's in a known environment, it will know the area it's operating in, and will basically just be a short ferry service. But we'll then, like I did at first, my God, I'm terrified, I'm going to die in this, through to, this is actually pretty cool, I want to buy it. It'll actually get you over that hurdle of, well, do I want the tech? Will I want to buy the tech? Will I want to use the technology? So that first mile, last mile will be the actual way to break that concern. And then eventually we'll, as we talk here, so we drive, we'll move into this area where we're going to see an accident frequency rate reduce and a less severe damage rate reduce. The numbers being quoted in Australia are a 60% drop in frequency and a massive drop in size. So there will still be some accidents, there will still be some incidents, but when you think that 90% of all collisions are human error, all this technology is designed to eliminate that human error. So what does that do to our industry? Then when you think about less severe damage, all the technology is designed to reduce, if something does happen, the severity of the incident. So where it may be a heavy knock and the car's going to be rubber, that might move into a medium size. Where it's going to be a medium knock at the moment, it might move into a light. And the light that you have today won't even happen at all. So it really needs to sort of, you start thinking about how does it impact what we do, how we do it, how we price risk, how we understand risk, and how do we actually attract customers that want to use this technology in the future. Okay. And with that, I thank you very much and open for questions. I hope that was close to time.
My name is James, I'm from Holler. What do you imagine will happen to the price of insurance? So if pricing is based on relative risk, and the relative risk of something that's unpredictable, like humans, to something that's completely predictable, like fully automation or fully automated cars?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's as risk increases, the public will expect pricing will decrease for insurance. What's the future of that? I've heard everything crazy from it'll be an option on the home and contents policy for $50-odd, and I've also heard that liability will be manufacturer's liability rather than individuals covering individual vehicles. So there's a whole gamut of thinking about what will happen in the future. There's no actual answer yet, they're still working through all the different scenarios, as we're doing as well, working through scenarios as well. But how do you remain relevant? And RSEQ was a great example. The presentation they gave at QUT last week was that people always want to drive. Well, people always want to ride horses. Now they do it at a horse farm. At some point in the future, you won't be legally able to drive. And they're already talking about dates for that. You'll be considered the drunk driver today if you're driving a vehicle manually.
Thank you.
So, David from QV. Given the future we're talking about, especially in pods and CBDs and companies like Uber, business model probably makes a lot more sense without actual real drivers in the car. What do you think of investments like Sydney's making in light rail down George Street? Is that worthwhile or is that kind of short-sighted?
Yeah, it's actually a really good question. I read a paper from the WA government, still in draft at the moment, where they're actually looking at already planning out the infrastructure for the next 50 years. And they're already thinking about when do we stop doing traffic lights, stop signs, give way signs, when do we actually start cutting back on the infrastructure. And one of the big things that people talk about is they can't afford to build new roads and newer freeways and, you know, bridges at the moment. This technology allows you to have more vehicles on the same roads operating much closer. So whether you then want to invest in light rail, public transport, whether your mobility becomes a mixed mode environment where you're using pods for last mile, first mile, then public transport, yeah, still to be determined. It's evolving, there's lots of thinking on that, but no real answers yet. I'm not sure I'll be investing the money at that.
Hi, Chow Chow from PwC. In the spirit of disruptions, what's the latest on electric cars? And the reason why I ask is sometimes, you know, people from the climate change industry would tell you about how electric cars can be made and how the government can build these charging tracks on roads.
Yep.
And autonomous cars would be able to automatically charge themselves, as well as giving the government some sort of control on your car via the tracks.
The biggest problem they start talking about, those sort of arguments, are that who pays for that infrastructure rollout to charge the vehicles? So Bosch, recently at a conference I was at, they announced that by 2020, capacity would be doubled and weight would be halved. By 2025, the electric vehicle will be cheaper to buy and own than a combustion-powered engine vehicle. So they're already working on ways to extend the life, extend the range, reduce range anxiety, which have you guys heard of that term before? Yeah, so the concern about, you know, my vehicle can do a range of 150 k's, only travel 50 k's each day, but I'm terrified I'm going to run out of electricity at some point. So they're extending the range of vehicles. Tesla's are now to about 250 with rapid charging. There's charge points for Bosches that can get down to about 30 minutes for a charge. So it will, in 2020, I'm expecting that range will be maybe 500 k's. By 2025, it will be 1,000 k's per charge, would be my expectation. So why would they then build infrastructure into a road to charge a vehicle? And who pays for that? I think it'd be more a case of at McDonald's, at KFC's, at restaurants that, you know, who are in the Sydney, Brisbane run, about the halfway point, there'll be somewhere to stop for lunch, charge a car, just to pop up a bit, and then off you go again. So I think most government planners are really looking at the future of infrastructure cost versus reward and the longevity of that infrastructure, and I think that's one of the things they'll rule out pretty quickly.
Hi, Bhavan Gondoski from PwC. I think another questioner mentioned Uber, and I wanted to dig down to that a little bit, because the CEO of Uber got in trouble about a year ago for saying, oh yeah, autonomous cars might be good too, because, you know, people who drive for Uber didn't really want to be replaced by autonomous cars. In that kind of environment, what's the role for individuals being their own driver, rather than like kind of a network of cars like Uber doing the driving?
I think we will get to a point where we do mobility on demand, but there's a point where I think individual ownership won't make sense anymore. At the moment, you use your car for around about 5% of the day. It depreciates and loses you money every second of the day that you don't use it. So I think they'll go to a point where you'll buy vehicles that can do this technology. You may then get dropped off at work and it'll join a taxi fleet during the day in the early years. But eventually it'll be companies like Ford. They've already announced they're doing experiments around the world. And they announced at CES this year that they don't see the future in selling one-to-one sales of vehicles in the US. And that didn't impact their share price at all. So they're really looking at Uber models in the US. In India, they're looking at selling one car to three or four people in one village. They're looking at what's the right business model for each location in the world. So there's already the manufacturers trying to work out one-to-one sales aren't the future. What are the future of mobility?
I thought I read on the weekend that BMW already in there building into their steering wheels technology so that it tells them, the driver, where the nearest drop-off point for the car is. So they're really anticipating that just people will
share cars. And Audi in Germany have a system at the moment where you pay an annual lease or monthly lease fee. You can use any vehicle in their fleet. So you can use the R8 super sports car on the weekend when you've got the hot date. But then Monday morning you pick up the A1 because you're driving back and forth commuting to work. Cost you the same no matter what vehicle you've got, and you can change any time you want during the month. So they see at the moment we buy a wagon because we need that once or twice a month, but we really need a hatchback for the rest of the week to drive to work or the rest of the month to drive to work. So they actually see we make compromises now on what we buy. In the future, you'll actually book what you need for that specific ride, whether it's a family wagon because you've got seven kids and the groceries, or just myself because I'm going down the shops or going to a mate's and I just need a single seater. So you'll book and pay for the services you need at the time.
Tom Beers from PwC. I was just wondering what some of the broader societal impacts are going to be. For example, I wouldn't imagine that 100,000 truck drivers are going to be happy to lose their jobs. Yeah. What are the unions going to say, et cetera, et cetera?
So the scariest report I've read on that is in the US, current number now, it's around 10%, I think it was 10.5% of the US workforce will be displaced by this technology. And it's 10% of the population who can't retrain to be computer programmers, who can't retrain to be engineers. So it's a huge societal shift. And some of the things that we talk about internally and we talk about with our partners is that we're going to see as much change in society over the next 10 to 15 years as we saw going from the horse and cart to the automobile. We're going to see that sort of shift. So there's going to be societal impacts, there's going to be commercial impacts, obviously companies like ours. There's also going to be positive and negatives in those environments. So it's working out how you identify the opportunities and maybe find those and hitch onto those. And for a society, you know, if I have kids that want to be cabbies or truck drivers, perhaps give them the suggestion of doing a different career.
On that sort of looking at wider implications, I think except in the US where you're more likely to be shot, the most common cause of accident in most countries is car accidents. So we're looking at, if this is true, then we're looking at big changes in terms of accident emergency, in terms of accident insurance and fatality, and you know, another big increase to longevity as well.
Correct. So, and the other thing, I heard some great stuff the other day that, so 90% of all accidents are caused by human error. It's interesting because also 90% of most drivers think that they're better than the average driver. So how they can be better than the average when it's 90%, you guys are mathematicians, not me, maybe you can work that out, but I can't. So I think, yeah, when you see and sort of talk about the compounding impact of this technology having, it's the impacts to health, the impacts to life insurance, the impacts to people living in nursing homes compared to now being able to live at home because they've actually got mobility and get the services without actually having to drive. It really does change a lot of the way we live, and a lot of the way our parents, grandparents may live in the future, and how our kids may get around as well. So huge change potentially, and a lot of shift in potentially how they fund infrastructure and health and all sorts of things.
You mentioned before that there'll be a date in the future where it'll just be illegal to drive manually. What do you think about it'll do to the sports car industry?
So
the sports car industry.
Okay, so our Shannon's type customer?
Yeah, because some people, you're buying these cars to drive them. That's the point.
It's a great question. It's one of the things we debate about a lot at work. I think people will always want to drive. There'll be drivers, people that will want to drive a sports car, that will want to drive race cars, whatever the case may be. However, as I said before, much like horse riding today, you go to horse parks and you ride on trails and do things like that. There'll be a point in time where an autonomous vehicle will tow you and your race car to a track day, you'll drive like a lunatic, get back in the car, the thing will take you home. And I think that's where, and that's not 5 years, 10 years away, but at some point you won't legally be able to drive, that's what you'll do.
Nick Whitlock here from Suncorp. Steve, how are the companies like Bosch resolving ethical dilemmas like, if I have to avoid a collision, do I kill the pedestrian or do I kill the driver?
It's an interesting one. The best answer I've heard of that, so there was a lot of people saying, well, you'd have to have computer programs to make the call. You know, do I hit the grandmother walking with the walking stick, or do I hit the old lady, the lady pushing the pram, or do I hit the school bus versus the truck, or whatever the case may be. They're now actually matching philosophy professors with technology, departments to actually work out how do you code for that. So you think those two streams would not be, bedfellows in any way, shape or form, but they're actually trying to think of, how do you make those decisions? How do you actually program the car to decide life or death decisions? And they're looking towards turning to philosophy, turning to different forms of schools of thought to actually how you actually program that. So still being worked through. But they are coming up with some interesting ideas around it.
Hi, Francesca from Finity. Back to the more immediate future, in the video that we saw from Bosch, the stuff that guy was doing is illegal right here now. So how quickly are governments going to keep up with that, and how soon are we going to be able to drive like that on our roads legally?
So the conference is happening in Adelaide in November. They're closing the freeway down for 6 hours, going to do some on-road demonstrations. There's a program of work to engage with regulators and governments around Australia to actually get them on board with this technology. So there are rules and certain rules in place where you can't do mobile phones while you're driving, you can't let go of the steering wheel, things like that. I think they're going to, there's a real program of work to actually demonstrate to governments that this technology does enable that. So they're, like most regulations, it's lagging behind the technology, but we're trying to drag them, or others are trying to drag them, kicking and screaming into the new tech world. So it won't be tomorrow, but it's certainly a focus of work at the moment.
Can I just ask you a question about that? Because I've thought about that, and the concern I have about it isn't that people can text while they're on autonomous driving, is that they get used to texting while they're on autonomous driving. So then when they're on manual driving, which we'll still have, obviously in the short term, a lot of manual driving, they will think it's okay to text. And having, you know, a 17-year-old son who's just got his P's for 2 weeks, you know, I've sort of really focused on this. You don't use your phone while you're driving. So that's my kind of risk concern.
I'll leave you at that concern by giving you a much greater one. As technology increases, we're going to de-skill drivers. As vehicles make more decisions for you and make overriding decisions, if you turn the wheel hard, it won't allow you to crash into that hedge, or you know, you basically it's going to correct your driver input errors. But then if you get in your son's car or an old classic car that doesn't have that technology, potentially you're going to crash more than what you would have before. And the studies that NASA have done on cockpit automation have shown that pilots were having controlled crashes in the 80s because they'd lost the ability to fly. I read a report recently of a pilot that flew for a year but actually only flew the plane for 6 hours over that 12-month period because he was an automatic pilot for the rest of the time. So when things go wrong, they actually were having major problems in actually how I get control, what's happening around me. There's real concerns around that. So in the airline industry, they've actually completely rejigged the way they train pilots and keep their skill sets up to actually recover from stalls or crash potential situations or whatever the case may be. How do you do that in a vehicle where you've got 2 or 3 seconds lead time, where you've got car vibrating around you, you know, 10 feet, 3 feet, 5 feet off you, compared to a plane that's 30,000 feet in the air with people on the ground watching it every second? It's a really interesting question. So there's a lot of concern at the moment about, in a level 3 going back and forth, how does someone become aware quick enough to control if something goes wrong, and as you de-skill, how do you actually train and maintain and try and maybe improve skill sets as they start falling off? So there you go.
Thank you for that. So I think that's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, Steve, for it. We do have the traditional Actuaries Institute bottle of wine, not to obviously drink while you're driving, but once you're in an autonomous car, you could just sit there drinking away, of course. And if you'd all join me in thanking Steve.